Solomon. Ben Solomon. I don't remember seeing his name. Just got him last night. Raid on the Sfat police station. They were trying to steal arms. He killed two policemen with a grenade. Yes, indeed. You're a mean little sheeny, aren't you? Ben Solomon stood calm, with his eyes blazing contempt at the inspector. Don't take his gag off, Major Caldwell, or he'll start singing psalms for you. He's a fanatic little bastard. The inspector became annoyed at the boy's steady, withering glare. He took a step toward Ben Solomon and smashed him in the mouth, sending him crashing to the floor, bloody and tangled in his chains. "Get him out of here," the inspector snapped in a nervous voice. The boy was shoved on the floor in the back of the car. One armed soldier sat in back with him, and Caldwell sat in front next to the driver. They drove out of the Taggart Fort.
"Dirty little bastard," the driver mumbled. "Ask me, Major Caldwell. They ought to turn us loose on these Jews here a few weeks. That's what we should do, by rights."
"Cubber of mine got it last week," the guard in the back said. "And a fine bloke he was, too. Had a wife and a new baby. Them Maccabees give it to him right through the head, they did."
As they drove into the Bet Shean Valley, the three men relaxed. They were now in all Arab territory, and the danger of attack was gone until they reached the Jerusalem area. Caldwell turned around and looked at the prisoner on the floor. The juices of hatred churned in his stomach. He detested Bruce Sutherland. He knew in his heart that Sutherland was helping the Haganah. Sutherland was a Jew lover. Sutherland had intentionally let the catastrophe on Cyprus occur. Caldwell remembered standing near the barbed wire at the Carolus camp and a fat Jewish woman spitting out on him. He looked back at the boy on the floor. The guard sat in the middle of the seat. One heavy boot was planted on Ben Solomon's head, and he snickered with amusement.
"Dirty Jew," Caldwell mumbled under his breath.
He could see a parade of them, the bearded characters in London's Whitechapel, and he could smell the smell of pickles. The line of pawn shops, they sat hunched over their benches, mumbling prayers. Caldwell could see the little boys on their way to Jew school with the black caps on their heads. They drove toward the all-Arab city of Nablus. Caldwell smiled as he remembered the officers' club and the sheeny jokes. He could see his mother leading him into the office of an arrogant Jew doctor. "And they think Hitler was wrong," Caldwell thought. "Hitler knew what the score was. It was bloody well too bad that the war ended before he could do them all in." Caldwell remembered entering Bergen-Belsen with Sutherland. Sutherland was sick at what he saw. Well, Caldwell wasn't sick. The more Jews dead, the better. They passed into an Arab village with a record of known hostility toward the Yishuv. It was an Husseini strong point.
"Stop the car," Caldwell ordered. "Now you two men listen to me. We are throwing this kike out."
"But Major, they'll murder him," the guard said.
"I admit I'm put out at the Jews, sir," the driver said, "but we got a responsibility to deliver our prisoner, we has."
"Shut up," Caldwell barked, half hysterically. "I said we are throwing him out. Both of you are to swear he was taken by Maccabees who roadblocked us. If you open your mouth otherwise, you'll end up in ditches. Am I clear?"
The two soldiers merely nodded as they saw the mad look in Caldwell's eyes. Ben Solomon was unchained from the floor. The car slowed near the coffee house. The boy was hurled into the street, and they sped away for Jerusalem. It worked just as Caldwell knew it would. Within an hour, Ben Solomon had been killed and mutilated. He was decapitated. The bodiless head was held up by the hair and photographed with 20 laughing Arabs around it. The picture was sent out as a warning of what was going to happen to all the Jews sooner or later. Major Fred Caldwell made a disastrous mistake. One of the Arabs in the coffee house who saw the boy thrown from the car was a member of the Maccabees. General Sir Arnold Havenhurst, KBE, CB, DSO, MC, was infuriated. He paced the office of his headquarters in the Schneller compound in Jerusalem, then snatched Cecil Bradshaw's letter from his desk and read it again. "The situation has degenerated to such a state that unless means can be recommended for immediate stabilization by you, I will be compelled to suggest the matter be turned over to the United Nations." The United Nations, indeed. The tall blonde man snorted and crumpled the letter and threw it to the floor. A week before, Havenhurst had ordered a boycott on all Jewish places of business. This was to be his thanks after fighting the Jews for 5 years. He had warned the Home Office in World War II not to take these Jews into the British Army, but no, they wouldn't listen. Now, lose the Palestine mandate. Havenhurst went to his desk and began working on an answer to Bradshaw's letter. "I propose immediate adoption of the following points, which in my opinion will stabilize Palestine. 1. Suspension of all civil courts with fines and punishments and prison terms to be dispensed by the military commander. 2. Dissolve the Yishuv Central, disband the Zion Settlement Society, and all other agencies of the Jews. 3. Cessation of all Jewish newspapers and publications. 4. Swift, quiet elimination of some 60 top Yishuv leaders. Haj Amin el-Husseini has proved this method successful against his political opposition. This phase could be carried out by Arab confederates. 5. Complete use of the Arab Legion of Transjordan. 6. Imprisonment of several hundred secondary leaders in the Yishuv and their subsequent quick banishment to some remote African colonies. 7. Grant the military commander the right to destroy any kibbutz, moshav, village, or part of a city found with arms. Institute a nationwide screening with all illegals to be deported at once. 8. Impose collective fines against the entire Jewish population for every act of Maccabee terror, and place these fines so high the Jews will begin to cooperate in the apprehension of these gangsters. 9. Offer larger rewards for information on key Maccabee terrorists, Aliyah Bet agents, Haganah heads, etc. 10. Hang or execute every apprehended Maccabee gangster on the spot. 11. Institute a series of boycotts on Jewish business, farm products, and halt all Jewish imports and exports. Keep complete control on all the movements of all Jewish vehicles. 12. Destroy the Palmach by armed attacks on kibbutzim known to be harboring them. My forces have been compelled to operate under most difficult circumstances. We have been made to follow the rules and restrain ourselves from the widest and most effective use of our powers. On the other hand, the Maccabees, Haganah, Palmach, and Aliyah Bet observe no rules and, indeed, attack our restraint as a weakness. If I am allowed to use my power, I assure that order will be restored in short time. General Sir Arnold Havenhurst, KBE, CB, DSO, MC. Chatham House, Institute of Foreign Relations, London. Cecil Bradshaw's color was a sickly gray when General Tever Brown finally reached his office.
"Well, Bradshaw, you asked Havenhurst for his ideas. You have them now."
"Has the man gone mad? Good Lord! His report reads like Adolf Hitler's final solution."
Bradshaw picked up the 12-point Havenhurst report and shook his head.
"God knows we want to keep Palestine, but murder? Burning villages? Hangings? Starvation? I cannot recommend this beastly thing. Even if I did, I don't know whether you have enough men in the British Army who could carry it out. I've been for the Empire all my life, Sir Clarence, and many's the time we've had to take harsh and unfair measures in our own behalf. But I also believe in God. We're just not going to hold Palestine this way. I wash my hands of the matter. Let someone else endorse Havenhurst. I won't."
Cecil Bradshaw took the Havenhurst report and crumpled it. He put it in his large ashtray and put a match to it and watched it burn.
"Thank God we've got the courage to answer for our sins," he whispered.
The question of the Palestine Mandate was thrown open to the United Nations. Chapter 7. Now it was the late spring of 1947, and Ari Ben-Kanan disappeared from Kitty Fremont's life. She did not see or hear from him after Mount Tabor. If Ari had given any messages to Jordana, Jordana had not delivered them. The two women scarcely spoke a word to each other. Kitty tried to be tolerant, but Jordana made even that difficult. The Palestine Mandate issue was handed over for the United Nations to attempt to unscramble it. United Nations machinery was in the process of forming a committee of small, neutral nations to investigate the problem and come up with recommendations for the General Assembly. The Yishuv Central and the World Zionists accepted mediation of the problem by the United Nations. On the other side, the Arabs used threats, boycotts, blackmail, and any other pressure they could find to keep the Palestine issue away from an impartial judgment. At Gan Dafna, the Gadna military training speeded up. The youth village became a chief arms depot. Rifles were brought in to be cleaned by the children and then smuggled in village trucks to Hula settlements and the Palmach. Time and again, Karen was called upon to go out on arms smuggling missions. The assignments were accepted by her and the other children without question. Kitty's heart was in her mouth every time Karen went out, but she had to keep her silence. Karen doggedly continued to press the search for her father without success. The once bright promise at La Ciotà faded. The girl retained contact with the Hansens in Denmark. Karen wrote each week, and each week a letter and often a package arrived from Copenhagen. Mette and Arg Hansen had given up all hope of ever getting her back. Even if Karen did not find her father, there was something in the girl's letters that indicated she was lost to them. Karen's identification with Palestine and being Jewish became a nearly complete thing. The only qualification was Kitty Fremont. Dov Landau was taking strange turns. At times he would appear to be breaking out of his reclusion, and in those moments he and Karen added a deeper dimension to their relationship. Then the very audacity of his coming into the clear light would force Dov back into his shell. Whenever he was able to reason about his role, he disliked himself for what he felt he was doing to Karen. Then loyalty to him produced self-pity, and he at once hated and loved her. He felt he must not contaminate Karen with himself, yet he did not wish to cut off his only link with humanity. The times he would sink back again into bitterness, he often stared at the blue tattoo number on his arm by the hour. He would turn to his books and his painting with a savage concentration and close out all living things. Just as he neared the bottom, Karen would succeed in pulling him out of it. His bitterness never quite grew so deep that he could turn on her. In the time that Kitty Fremont had been at Gan Dafna, she had made herself one of the most important persons in the village. Dr. Lieberman leaned on her more each day. Looked upon as a sympathetic outsider, she was frequently able to exert the needed extra influence of someone outside the family. Dr. Lieberman's friendship was becoming one of the most rewarding she had ever known. She was completely integrated into the life of Gan Dafna. She did splendid work with disturbed children, yet a barrier still remained. She knew that she was partly responsible for it, but she wanted it that way. Kitty was far more at ease with Bruce Sutherland than she was with the people of Gan Dafna. With Sutherland, she was in her own element, and she looked forward with increasing impatience to those free days that she and Karen could spend at his villa. When she was with Sutherland, it renewed her awareness of the difference between herself and the Jews. Harriet Saltzman came to Gan Dafna 2 times. On both occasions, the old woman pleaded with Kitty to take charge of one of the new youth Aliyah centers in the Tel Aviv area. Kitty was a wizard at organization and a stickler for routine. This, plus her overall experience and ability, was badly needed at places not so well run as Gan Dafna. Harriet Saltzman wisely calculated that the outside influence of a Kitty Fremont would be a tremendous asset to a youth Aliyah center. Kitty refused. She was settled at Gandafna, and Karen was completely at home. She did not seek a career in youth Aliyah, and had no aspirations. The main reason, however, was that she did not want to be placed in a capacity where she would have to answer for Gadna activities and arms smuggling. This would put her into the category of a participant. Kitty clung to her neutrality. Her work was going to remain professional and not political. To Karen Clement, Kitty Fremont was like an older sister who was raising her without the help of parents. Kitty made herself indispensable to the girl. The Hansons in Denmark faded from her life, and there had been no progress in finding her father. This left only Dove, and Dove gave nothing. Kitty encouraged this condition of dependence. She wanted Karen to need her. She wanted Karen to need her so much the need would defeat the hidden foe. The power of Eretz Yisrael. With the passing of the weeks, holidays came and left Gandafna. There had been Tu Shvat in the late winter, an Arbor Day, to perpetuate the fanatical tree planting of the Jews. Late in the month of March came Heroes Day. Yordana ben Canaan led the Gadna troops on a hike along the border ridges to Tel Hai, where Barak and Akiva had entered Palestine from Lebanon. It was now hallowed ground. At Trumpledor's grave, soldiers of the Palmach and the young soldiers of Gadna gathered to pay homage to the new heroes. The glorious festival of Purim came. Gandafna erupted with Mardi Gras and Halloween-like costumes, and floats and decorations that turned it into a carnival. The Purim story was told of how Queen Esther saved the Jews, then in the Persian Empire. The evil Haman, the Amalekite, plotted to have the Jews annihilated, but Esther unmasked Haman and saved her people. The grave of Esther was on the border of Fort Esther, where part of the celebration took place. The Purim story was a real thing to the children of Gandafna, for almost all of them had been victims of a later-day Haman, named Adolf Hitler. Passover came and went. The holiday of Lag BaOmer occurred on the full moon 30 days after the end of Passover, and in time became a memorial to the second uprising of the Hebrews against the Romans. Homage was paid to the great sages buried in the city of Tiberias and in Sfat and in Meron. There were the graves of Moses Maimonides, the immortal philosopher and physician, and of the rabbis Haya, Eliezer, and Kahana, and of the great revolutionary Rabbi Akiva. There was the grave of Rabbi Meir, the miracle maker. All these were in Tiberias, where the festival started, and whence it moved to Sfat. From Sfat the pious moved in a great gathering body to Meron, and to the graves of Yochanan, the sandal-maker, and Hillel, and Shammai. The ancient synagogue still stood in part at Meron, with its door which was supposed to welcome the return of the Messiah. Of all the rabbis praised on Lag BaOmer, Shimon bar Yochai received the greatest reverence. Bar Yochai defied the Roman edicts which banned Judaism, and he fled to the village of Pekin, where he lived in a cave, and where the Lord provided him with a carob tree for food and a stream for water. He lived in hiding for 17 years. One day each year he came to Meron to teach the forbidden Torah to his disciples. It is said by both Mohammedans and Christians that they owe the life of their religions to those rabbis who kept Judaism alive in hiding. Without Judaism and the Holy Torah, neither Christianity nor Islam could have survived, for their roots were in the Torah, and their very life and air and blood were the doctrines of Judaism. While in hiding, Bar Yochai wrote the Zohar, the brightness, which was the standard work of the mystic Kabbalah. Hasidic and Oriental celebrants converged on the holy cities of Tiberias and Sfat from all corners of Palestine, and continued on to Meron to spend several days and nights in prayer and song and dance and praise of Shimon bar Yochai. When the month of May came, the rains were gone, and the Hula Valley and the hills of Syria and Lebanon turned a rich green, and the valleys filled with carpets of wildflowers, and the buds on the spring roses of Galilee burst into magnificent reds and whites and oranges, and once again, Gandafna prepared for a holiday. It was time for Shavuot, to celebrate the bringing of the first fruits of the new year. All holidays concerned with farming were particularly close to the hearts of the Jews of Palestine. Shavuot at Gandafna had become traditional for the coming of delegations from the Hula settlements to the children's village to share in the celebration. Again, Gandafna took on the air of a carnival as truckloads of farmers arrived from the Yad El Moshav. Sarah ben Canaan came. They arrived from the border kibbutzim of Kfar Giladi, up on the Lebanon border. They came from Ayelet HaShachar kibbutz on the lake, and from Ein Or. They came from Dan on the Syrian border, and from Manara on the mountaintop. Dr. Lieberman expressed his disappointment to Harriet Saltzman and Kitty that the Arab delegation from Abu Yeshah was only half the usual size, and that Taha was missing. The meaning was obvious and saddening. Kitty managed to see each truck as it arrived. She hoped that Ari ben Canaan would come, and she was unable to mask her disappointment. Yordana, in turn, watched Kitty with a cynical smirk. Some soldiers came from Fort Esther. These were among the friends who always tipped off the village when an arms search was on the way. The day was filled with merriment. There were athletic contests and open house in the classrooms and laboratories. There was horror dancing on the center green, and outdoor tables bent under the weight of food. At sundown, everyone moved to the outdoor theater cut into a hillside, set in the middle of a stand of pine trees. The theater filled to overflowing. Hundreds more lay about on the surrounding lawns. As it turned dark, multicolored lights came on, strung through the pines. The Gandafna Orchestra played Hatikva, the Hope, and Dr. Lieberman spoke a brief welcome and signaled the parade of Shavuot to begin. He returned to his seat with Kitty, Sutherland, and Harriet Saltzman. Karen led the parade. The instant Kitty saw her, she felt fear. Karen sat astride a large white horse and balanced the staff of the flag with the white field and the blue star of David. She wore dark blue slacks and an embroidered peasant's blouse and sandals on her feet. Her thick brown hair was done in pigtails and hung to her small breasts. Kitty gripped the arms of her chair. Karen looked the very spirit of the Jews. "Have I lost her? Have I lost her?" The wind whipped the flag and her horse broke for a second, but Karen turned it into line quickly. "She is gone from me as she is from the Hansons," Kitty thought. Harriet Saltzman was looking at Kitty, and Kitty lowered her eyes. Karen passed out of the spotlight, and the parade continued. The five tractors of Gandafna were polished and shined. Each pulled a flat car loaded with fruits and vegetables and grains grown at the village farm. Jeeps and trucks and station wagons buried under flowers from the gardens passed by. Trucks passed by, filled with children in peasants' clothing, holding rakes and hoes and scythes and power tools. The livestock was passed in review, led by the cows, which were decked in ribbons and flowers, and the horses were shiny, with manes and tails braided. The sheep and goats were herded past, and then the pet dogs and cats, and a monkey, and white rats, and hamsters were led or carried in affectionate display. Children passed holding cloth of material they had grown, spun, and woven, and newspapers they had printed, and their artwork, and baskets, and pottery. Their athletic teams marched by. When the parade was done, there was a final rousing cheer from the audience. Dr. Lieberman's secretary slipped alongside him and whispered into his ear.
"Excuse me, please," he said. "I have an important phone call."
"Hurry back," Harriet Saltzman called after him.
The lights in the trees were turned off, plunging the place into darkness for a moment before a spotlight shone on the stage. The curtain opened and the tambour beat, and a reed flute played an ancient melody. The children began to enact the Song of Ruth. It was done in pantomime against the plaintive sound background of the two instruments. Their costumes were authentic. The dances were the slow and sensuous movements of the days of Ruth and Naomi. Then came performers who danced with wild leaps and a passion like that of the dancers Kitty saw on top of Tabor. How they lived for the recreation of their past, Kitty thought. How dedicated they were to regaining the glory of Israel. Karen stepped onto the stage and commanded an instant, expectant hush. Karen danced the part of Ruth. Her movements told the simple and beautiful story of the Moabite girl and her Hebrew mother-in-law, who traveled to Beit Lechem, the house of bread. The story of love and of one God had been retold at Shavuot since the days of the Maccabees. Ruth had been a Gentile in the land of the Jews, yet Ruth was an ancestor of King David. Kitty's eyes were glued to Karen as she enacted Ruth's words to Naomi, that she would come to the land of the Hebrews with her. "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God." Kitty was dismayed as never before. Could she get Karen away from this? Kitty Fremont was the stranger. She would always be a stranger, the Gentile among the Hebrews. But she could not say, as Ruth had said, "Thy people shall be my people." Would this mean losing Karen? Dr. Lieberman's secretary tapped Kitty's shoulder.
"Would you come to Dr. Lieberman's office at once?" she whispered.
Kitty excused herself and slipped from her seat. She walked up to the top of the theater and looked back for a moment to see the children dancing the dance of the reapers and to watch Karen go to sleep at the feet of Boaz. She turned and left the theater. The path was dark, and she had to be careful of trenches. Kitty turned her pocket flashlight on the ground. She crossed the center green and passed the statue of Daphne. Behind her, she could hear the beat of the tambour and the cry of the flute. She walked quickly to the administration building, led by the single light. She opened the door to Dr. Lieberman's office.
"Good Lord,"
she said, startled at the sight of him.
"What's the matter? You look as though..."
"They have found Karen's father," he whispered.
Chapter 8. Bruce Sutherland drove Kitty and Karen to Tel Aviv the next day. Kitty used the pretext that she had to do some overdue shopping and wanted to give Karen her first look at the big city. They arrived slightly before the noon hour and checked into the Gat Rimon Hotel on Hayarkon Street on the Mediterranean. After lunch, Sutherland excused himself and left. The shops were closed during the midday hours, so Kitty and Karen romped along the sandy beach below the hotel, then cooled off from the heat with a refreshing swim. At 3 o'clock, Kitty ordered a taxi. They drove to Jaffa, where one of the faculty at Gan Daphna had recommended some great buys in Arab and Persian brass and copperware. Kitty wanted some things for the cottage. The taxi took them into a narrow, twisting street in the center of the Yaffa flea market. A row of shops were indentations in a crusader wall. They stopped before one of the holes in the wall, guarded by a fat individual sitting asleep in the doorway with a red fez tipped over his eyes. Kitty and Karen studied the shop. It was 5 feet wide and not much deeper, and a mess of hanging pots, pans, plates, jugs, vases, urns, candlesticks, and whatnot. The floor had not been swept for at least 10 years. The fat Arab sensed the presence of customers and awakened from his sleep. He gallantly gestured to the women to enter his domain. He shoved some brassware off 2 boxes and offered them as seats, then ran outside and called for his oldest son to get some coffee for the honored guests. The coffee arrived. Kitty and Karen sipped it and politely exchanged smiles with the shopkeeper. The son stood by the door, a portrait in stupidity. A half dozen spectators gathered on the outside to observe the proceedings. The attempts to converse soon proved frustrating. There were grunts, gestures, and hand-wavings in place of a common language. Whereas Karen spoke Danish, French, German, English, and Hebrew, and Kitty spoke English, Spanish, and a smattering of Greek, the Arab was versed only in Arabic. He sent his son out once again to find the flea market interpreter, and in another few minutes the intermediary was produced. The interpreter's English was of a pidgin variety, but he was conscientious, and the shopping commenced. Kitty and Karen browsed around the shop, blowing dust off encrusted antiques, some with 100 years' coating of dirt and tarnish to testify to their authenticity. After 40 tense minutes of womanly thoroughness, every piece in the shop had been handled by one or the other shopper. They settled on a pair of vases, 3 long-spouted Arab coffee pots of exquisite delicacy, and an enormous Persian plate with thousands of hand-engraved figures depicting an entire legend. Kitty asked the price for the entire lot, cleaned, polished, and delivered to her hotel. The crowd on the outside pressed closer as the interpreter and the proprietor went into a huddle. The interpreter turned and sighed.
Mr. Akim, him heart broke. These treasures to depart. Plate, he swear by Allah, 300 years.
Just how much is it going to take to mend Mr. Akim's broken heart? Kitty asked.
Because, lady, your daughter here so beautiful, Mr. Akim makes special bargain. Take all, 16 pounds sterling.
It's a steal, Kitty whispered to Karen.
You can't pay him what he asks, Karen said with exasperation. Do you want to ruin his stay by not bartering?
I'm taking it and running, Kitty whispered. That plate alone would cost $300 or $400 in the States.
Kitty, please,
Karen cried in disgust. She stepped in front of Kitty and the smile disappeared from Akim's face.
9 pounds sterling and not a grush more,
Karen announced firmly. The interpreter reported the counteroffer to Mr. Akim. Mr. Akim was offended. He went into wails of anguish. He had a large family to feed. Again, his kind heart was being taken advantage of. The items picked by these sharp-eyed women, they knew were antiques. On his honor, his father's honor, and by Allah's beard. 13 pounds.
12, and that's final.
Akim sobbed that he was being cheated, but he was a poor Arab, so what could he do? He was putty in the hands of these clever women. 12 and a half. It was a deal. The bartering was over, and smiles bloomed within and without the shop. There was an extended handshaking ceremony. Akim blessed Kitty and Karen and all their subsequent offspring. She left the name of her hotel and advised Akim he would be paid when the cleaned and polished goods were delivered. She tipped the interpreter and the stupid son, and they left. They walked through the flea market, amazed by the amount that could be jammed into the tiny shops and the degree of filth one street could collect.
As they approached the end of the street, a man who looked like a Sabra stepped up to Karen and exchanged several words in Hebrew and walked away quickly.
What did he want?
He saw by my uniform I was a Jew. He wanted to know if you were English. I told him who you were, and he advised us to return to Tel Aviv. There might be trouble.
Kitty looked down the street, but the man was gone.
He must have been a Maccabee, Karen said. Let's get out of here.
Kitty's heart was in her mouth until they were out of Jaffa. They drove to the intersection of Allenby Road and Rothschild Boulevard. Allenby Road was filled with new shops, and Rothschild was a wide street with a center parkway lined with ultra-modern three-storied white apartment houses. It was a striking contrast to the flea market of Jaffa. Cars and buses moved in a steady flow, and people walked with the big city gait, all in a hurry.
It is so thrilling, Karen said. I'm glad I was able to come. It is hard for me to realize that everyone here, bus drivers and waiters and salespeople, are all Jews. They built this whole city, a Jewish city. You don't understand what that means, do you? A city in which everything belongs to the Jews?
Karen's words annoyed Kitty.
In America, we have many important Jews, Karen, and they are very happy and very much American. But it's not the same as a Jewish country. It's not the same as knowing that wherever you go, and whatever you do, there is still one corner of the earth where you are wanted and that belongs to you.
Kitty fished in her purse quickly and took out a piece of paper.
Where would this address be?
Karen looked at the paper.
2 blocks down. When are you going to learn to read Hebrew?
Never, I'm afraid,
Kitty said, then added quickly,
I chipped 2 teeth trying to say some words yesterday.
They found the address. It was a dress shop.
What are you going to get?
Karen asked.
I'm going to buy you a decent wardrobe. It's a surprise from Brigadier Sutherland and me.
Karen stopped dead.
I couldn't, she said. What's the matter, dear? There is nothing wrong with what I'm wearing. It's fine for Gandafna, Kitty said. I have all the clothing I need,
Karen insisted. Sometimes she sounds like Yordana Ben Canaan, Kitty thought.
Karen, let's not forget that you are a young lady. You won't be betraying the cause if you dress up in something nice once in a while. I'm quite proud of...
Oh, quiet,
Kitty said with finality.
You sound more like a Sabra every day. When you are away from Gandafna with me, you are going to make me and Bruce proud of you.
Kitty appeared angry and sounded adamant. Karen bit her lip and retreated. She peeked out of the corner of her eye at the full-skirted mannequins in the window.
It isn't fair to the rest of the girls, she said in a final effort. We'll hide the dresses under the rifles if it will make you happy.
A few moments later, she was bouncing before the mirror, happily staging a one-woman fashion show and terribly pleased that Kitty had been insistent. It did feel so wonderful and look so wonderful. How long had it been since she wore nice things? Denmark. So long ago that she had almost forgotten. Kitty was as delighted as she watched Karen transform herself from peasant to soignée teenager. They walked the length of Allenby Road, still shopping, and turned into Ben Yehuda Street at the Mugrabi Square, loaded with packages. They plopped down at a table at the first sidewalk cafe. Karen gobbled an ice cream soda and watched the panorama of passing people with wide eyes. She shoved a spoonful of ice cream in her mouth.
This is the nicest day I can remember, she said. It would be perfect if Dov and Ari were here.
She was adorable, Kitty thought. Her heart was so filled with goodness, she wanted only to give to others. Karen meditated as she sipped from the bottom of the glass.
Sometimes I think we have picked a pair of lemons.
We?
You know, you and Ari, me and Dove.
I don't know what on earth gives you the impression there is something between Mr. Ben Kanaan and myself, but you are quite, quite, quite mistaken.
Ha, 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 Karen answered. Is that why you twisted your neck watching every truck that came in the gate before the Shavuot celebration yesterday? Just who were you looking for, if not Ari Ben Kanaan?
Hm, Kitty grunted, and sipped her coffee to cover her guilty confusion. Kitty shrugged as she wiped at her lips.
Gosh, anyone could tell you are sweet on him.
Kitty narrowed her eyes and glared at Karen.
You listen to me, Miss Smarty. Deny it, and I'll run up and down the street and shout it in Hebrew.
Kitty threw up her hands.
I can't win.
Someday you'll realize a man can be very attractive to us older women of 30 without there being the least bit of seriousness attached to it. I like Ari, but I'm sorry to have to dispel your romantic notions. Karen looked at Kitty with an expression that clearly said she was simply not convinced. The girl sighed and leaned close to Kitty and held her arm as though she were going to impart a deep, dark secret. Karen's mien took on the earnest sincerity of the teenager.
Ari needs you, I can tell that.
Kitty patted Karen's hand and adjusted a loose strand of hair in the girl's pigtail.
I wish I were 16 again, and things were so pure and uncomplicated. No, Karen, Ari Ben Kanaan comes from a breed of supermen whose stock in trade is their self-reliance. Ari Ben Kanaan hasn't needed anyone since the day he cut his teeth on his father's bullwhip. His blood is made up of little steel and ice corpuscles, and his heart is a pump like the motor in that bus over there. All this keeps him above and beyond human emotions.
She sat silent and very still, and her eyes looked beyond Karen.
You do care for him? Yes, Kitty sighed. I do. And what you said is right. We've got a pair of lemons. We'd better get back to the hotel. I want you to dress up for me and make yourself look like a princess. Bruce and I have a surprise for you. We'll take the pigtails down.
Karen indeed looked like a princess when Sutherland picked them up for dinner. The surprise was attendance at a touring French ballet company's staging of Swan Lake at the Habima National Theater, accompanied by the Palestine Philharmonic Orchestra. Karen leaned forward and sat on the edge of her seat during the entire performance, concentrating intently on the steps of the prima ballerina as she floated her way through the fairy tale. The overpowering, haunting beauty of the score filled her brain.
How beautiful it all was, Karen thought.
She had almost forgotten things like ballet were still in the world. How lucky she was to have Kitty Fremont. The stage was bathed in blue light, and the music swelled into the finale, with the storm and Siegfried defeating the evil von Rothbart and the beautiful swan maidens turning into women. Tears of happiness fell down her cheeks. Kitty watched Karen more than she watched the ballet. She sensed that she had awakened something dormant in the girl. Maybe Karen was rediscovering that there was something in the world she once had that was as important as the green of the fields of the Galilee. Kitty resolved again to keep this thing alive in Karen always. As much as the Jews had won her over, there was still much of her they could never get. Tomorrow Karen would see her father, and her world would move on in another direction. Kitty won something this day. They returned to the hotel late. Karen was bursting with happiness. She flung the hotel door open and danced through the lobby. The British officers raised their eyebrows. Kitty sent her up to get ready for bed and repaired to the bar with Sutherland for a nightcap.
Have you told her about her father yet?
No.
Do you want me to go with you?
I'd rather... alone.
Of course.
But please be there afterwards.
I'll be there.
Kitty stood up and kissed Sutherland on the cheek.
Good night, Bruce.
Karen was still dancing in their room when Kitty arrived.
Did you see Odette in the last scene?
She said, imitating the steps.
It's late, and you're a tired Indian. Oh, what a day, Karen said, flopping into her bed.
Kitty walked into the bathroom and changed. She could hear Karen humming the melodies of the ballet.
Oh, God, Kitty whispered. Why does this have to happen to her?
Kitty held her face in her hands and trembled.
Give her strength. Please, give her strength.
Kitty lay wide-eyed in the darkness. She heard Karen stir and looked over to the girl's bed. Karen arose and knelt beside Kitty's bed and lay her head on Kitty's bosom.
I love you so much, Kitty, Karen said. I couldn't love my own mother more.
Kitty turned her head away and stroked Karen's hair.
You'd better go to sleep,
Kitty said shakily.
We have a busy day tomorrow.
Kitty stayed awake, smoking one cigarette after the other, and occasionally pacing the floor. Each time she looked at the sleeping child, her heart tightened. Long past midnight, she sat by the window listening to the waves and looking at Jaffa on the bend of the coastline. It was 4 o'clock before Kitty fell into a restless, thrashing sleep. In the morning, she was heavy with depression, her face drawn and her eyes showing rings of sleeplessness beneath them. A dozen times she tried to broach the subject. Breakfast on the terrace was in silence. Kitty sipped her coffee.
Where is Brigadier Sutherland?
Karen asked.
He had to go out on business. He'll see us later this morning. What are we going to do today? Oh, a little of this and a little of that. Kitty, it's something about my father, isn't it?
Kitty lowered her eyes.
I guess I really knew all along. I didn't mean to deceive you, dear. What is it? Please tell me. What is it? He is very, very sick.
Karen bit her finger and her mouth trembled.
I want to see him. He won't know you, Karen.
Karen straightened up and looked off to the sea.
I've waited so long for this day. Please, every night since I knew the war was ending over 2 years ago, I've gone to sleep with the same dream. I lay in bed and pretended we were meeting each other again. I'd know just how he would look and what we are going to say to each other. At the DP camp and Carolus and in Cyprus all those months, I dreamed about it every night. My father and me. See, I always knew he was alive and kept going over and over it. Karen, stop it. It's not going to be the way you dreamed.
The girl trembled from head to foot. The palms of her hands were wet. She sprang from her chair.
Take me to him.
Kitty took her arms and gripped her tightly.
You must prepare for something terrible. Please, please, let's go. Try to remember. No matter what happens, no matter what you see, that I'm going to be right there. I'll be with you, Karen. Will you remember that? Yes, I'll remember it.
The doctor sat before Karen and Kitty. Your father was tortured by the Gestapo, Karen, the doctor said. In the early part of the war, they wanted him to work for them, and they made things very hard. They finally gave up. He was unable to work for them, even upon threat of danger to your mother and brothers.
I remember now, Karen said. I remember the letters stopped coming to Denmark, and how I was afraid to ask Arg about my family.
He was sent to Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia, and your mother and brothers...
I know about them.
They sent him to Theresienstadt in hope he would change his mind. After the war, he found out about your mother and brothers first. He felt guilty because he had waited too long to leave Germany and had trapped your mother and brothers. When he learned what had happened to them, on top of their years of torture, his mind snapped.
He will get better?
The doctor looked at Kitty. He has a psychotic depression, extreme melancholia.
What does that mean? Karen asked.
Karen, your father is not going to get well.
I don't believe you,
the girl said.
I want to see him.
Do you remember him at all?
Very little.
It would be far better to keep what you can remember than to see him now.
She must see him, Doctor, no matter how difficult it is going to be. This question cannot be left open, Kitty said.
The doctor led them down a corridor and stopped before a door. A nurse unlocked it. He held the door open. Karen walked into a cell-like room. The room held a chair, a stand, and a bed. She looked around for a moment, and then she stiffened. A man was sitting on the floor in a corner. He was barefooted and uncombed. He sat with his back against the wall and his arms around his knees, and stared blankly at the opposite wall. Karen took a step toward him. He was stubble-bearded, and his face was scarred. Suddenly, the pounding within Karen's heart eased.
This is all a mistake, she thought. This man is a stranger. He is not my father. He cannot be. It is a mistake. A mistake!
She was filled with the urge to turn around and scream out.
You see, you were wrong. He is not Johann Clement. He is not my father. My father is still alive somewhere and looking for me.
Karen stood before the man on the floor to assure herself. She stared into the crazed eyes. It had been so long. So very long. She could not remember. But the man she had dreamed about meeting again was not this man. There was a fireplace and the smell of pipe tobacco. There was a big, moppy dog. His name was Maximilian. A baby cried in the next room.
Miriam, see to Hans. I am reading a story for my girl, and I cannot be disturbed.
Karen Hansen Clement slowly knelt before the hulk of mindless flesh.
Grandma's house in Bonn always smelled of newly baked cookies. She baked all week, getting ready for the family on Sunday.
The insane man continued to stare at the opposite wall, as though he were alone in the room.
Look how funny the monkeys are in the Cologne Zoo. Cologne has the most wonderful zoo. When will it be carnival time again?
She studied the man from his bare feet to his scarred forehead. Nothing. Nothing she saw was like her father.
Jew! Jew! Jew!
The crowd screamed as she ran into her house with the blood pouring down her face.
There, there, Karen. Don't you cry. Daddy won't let them hurt you.
Karen reached out and touched the man's cheek.
Daddy, she said.
The man did not move or react. There was a train and lots of children around, and they were talking of going to Denmark, but she was tired.
Goodbye, Daddy,
Karen had said.
Here, you take my dolly. He will watch after you.
She stood on the platform of the train and watched her daddy on the platform. And he grew smaller and smaller.
Daddy! Daddy! Karen cried. It's Karen, Daddy! I'm your girl! I'm all grown up now, Daddy! Don't you remember me?
The doctor held Kitty in the doorway as she shook from head to foot.
Let me help her, please,
Kitty cried. Let it be done, he said. And Karen was filled with remembering.
Yes, yes, he is my father. He is my father. Daddy,
she screamed and threw her arms around him.
Please talk to me. Please say something to me. I beg you, beg you.
The man, who was once the living human person of Johann Clement, blinked his eyes. A sudden expression of curiosity came over his face as he became aware of a person clutching at him. He held the expression for a tense moment as though he were trying, in his own way, to allow something to penetrate the blackness. And then his look lapsed back into lifelessness.
Daddy!
She screamed.
Daddy! Daddy!
And her voice echoed in the empty room and down the long corridor.
Daddy!
The strong arms of the doctor pried her loose, and she was gently dragged from the room. The door was closed and locked, and Johann Clement was gone from her forever. The girl sobbed in anguish and crumpled into Kitty's arms.
He didn't even know me. Oh, my God. God, why doesn't he know me? Tell me, God. Tell me.
It's all right, baby. It is all right now. Kitty is here. Kitty is with you.
Don't leave me. Don't ever leave me, Kitty.
No, baby. Kitty won't ever leave you. Ever.
Chapter 9. The news of Karen's father had spread through Gandafna before she and Kitty returned. It had a shattering effect on Dov Landau. For the first time since his brother Mundek had held him in his arms in a bunker beneath the Warsaw ghetto, Dov Landau was able to feel compassion for someone other than himself. His sorrow for Karen Clement was, at last, the ray of light that illuminated his black world. She was the one person he could trust and care for. Why, of all people on earth, did it have to happen to her? How many times in that stinking camp on Cyprus had Karen expressed her simple, all-powerful faith to him? Now Karen was hurt, and her despair was deep pain to him. What did she have left? Himself and Mrs. Fremont. What was he to her? He was a millstone, a nothing. There were times he wanted to hate Mrs. Fremont, but he couldn't because he knew that she was good for Karen. With Karen's father out of the way, perhaps Mrs. Fremont would take her to America. He stood in the way. He knew Karen wouldn't leave him. In Dov's mind, there was only one thing to do. A youth named Mordecai was a secret recruiter for the Maccabees at Gandafna. From him, Dov succeeded in discovering where and how to make contact with the underground organization. The cottages of the faculty were never locked at Gandafna. He waited one evening until they were all at dinner, then rifled several cottages. He stole a few objects of gold jewelry and fled to Jerusalem. Bruce Sutherland went directly to Dr. Lieberman and got him to urge Kitty to bring Karen to Sutherland's villa for a week or two to allow her to recover from the shock. Karen bore her grief with the same dignity and courage that had carried her through a life filled with tragedy. Kitty Fremont was wise. She never left the girl's side. The fate of Karen's father, along with the disappearance of Dov Landau, added up to a grim victory for Kitty. She felt that in time she would be able to get Karen to America. Kitty thought about it constantly at Sutherland's villa, detesting herself at times for finding consolation in Karen's tragedy. But she could not stop her thoughts. Since she had first seen Karen in the tent at Carolos, her entire life had revolved around the girl. One day, after lunch, Ari Ben Canaan came to Sutherland's villa. He waited in the study while the servant fetched Sutherland from the terrace patio. Bruce excused himself and left the girls sunning. The two men spoke for nearly an hour, transacting their business.
"I have a friend of yours here," Sutherland said after they had concluded their discussion. "Kitty Fremont is spending a fortnight here as my house guest with the young Clement girl."
"I heard you two had become great friends," Ari said.
"Yes, I think Catherine Fremont is one of the finest women I have ever met. You should run up to Gandafna and see what she has done with some of those children. There was a boy who didn't even talk 6 months ago, who now has not only opened up, but is starting to play a bugle for the school band."
"I've heard about that, too," Ari said.
"I insisted she come here and bring the Clement girl. The child found her father. Poor chap is completely and incurably insane. It was a terrible shock, needless to say. Come on out to the garden."
"I'm sorry. I have some other things to attend to."
"Nonsense. Won't hear of it."
He took Ari's arm and led him out.
Kitty had not seen Ari since the Mount Tabor affair. She was startled by the first sight of him. Ari had been neglecting himself. She thought that Ari was amazingly gentle in his conveyance of condolence to Karen. He showed her a tenderness that he apparently reserved for his own people. He had never treated Kitty that way. Was this because Ari accepted Karen as one of them, Kitty wondered? Then she grew angry at herself. It seemed to her that